Okay, well, welcome one and all. The light's going down as a hint, I think. Just simply tell you who I am. I'm Tony Travers from the Government Department and the Institute for Public Affairs at the LSE. This event is... I've got to read this out to get it right. Part of the LSE Government Department of Government's Public Lecture Series, and the Twitter hashtag is hashtag LSE Identity. And the purpose of the evening really is to celebrate and to help launch this book, which is called Cultivating Political and Public Identity, Why Plumage Matters. And it has been written by our dear colleague, now retired, but emeritus professorial colleague, Rodney Barker, who is emeritus professor of government in the Department of Government. Who I vaguely remember, did you used to have Beatrice Rueb's desk, did I remember? I misremembered that.
That's exactly right.
You did, didn't you? Yes. I was always enormously impressed, not only by this about Rodney, but he did have Beatrice Rueb's desk, sort of linear link to the creation of the school and the Fabians and all that.
Yes, I touched it.
You must have touched it with your desk. Anyway, I can't get to touch most of the surface on my desk, to be honest, but that's for reasons of paper all over it. Anyway, enough for me. So, what we're going to do this evening is for Rodney to speak for 10 minutes, quarter an hour, 20 minutes about the book, why he wrote it, and what it purports to tell us, and then what it tells us. And then Dr. Shakuntala Banerjee is going to respond, followed by Professor Jean Seaton. So they will each respond, and we will then be able to open it up to a broader discussion, points you'd like to make, agreements and disagreements. I just, thinking about this topic and looking, reading through the book, it disgusts me that the word identity, not new, but is much discussed in contemporary political discourse. Day by day you can hear it being discussed in terms of its impact on nationalism, and in terms of its impact on community. And of course, these things can be good or bad. And what's intriguing about it, and the point is well made in the book about equality and inequality, that identity and the capacity to exclude or include, because identity can do both, can be a very powerful thing for the good, and it can also be a powerful thing the other way. If you talk about strong regional identity and all the signifiers of that, that's good. But identity politics is almost always used pejoratively. So, Rodney's book provides us insights from a number of different disciplines, and what we're going to do now is to hear from him about the book, then our two respondents, and then from all the rest of us. Rodney.
Thank you. I'm quite pleased to see that amongst those who are here today, there are at least representatives of people or organisations who have made this book possible. And I ought to say that right at the beginning. It's only LSE's first open access book because of the most wonderful support from our library. We have two representatives of the library here today, Nancy Graham and Dimitri Flanagan, so thank you to you and to all your colleagues. The LSE Library is exactly what a library should be, an innovative, a supportive, a dynamic resource for all the things we do. And we are here very well served. I should also thank the Manchester University Press, who also had a hand in making this book open access, and their representatives are here or outside, Caroline Winterskill and Alan Richards. And of course, as is so often the case, behind even a partially successful partner, there is usually a surprised woman, and without the support of my critical, sceptical but humorous support of my wife Helen Roberts, there would have been no book at all. I ought to start by saying something about the book and about the title. It's a joke, it's a historical joke, and it arises from the attack which was made at the end of the 19th century against Edmund Burke by Tom Paine. Edmund Burke had attacked the French Revolution, had defended monarchy, aristocracy, privilege, inequality, and all the glories of Versailles, which were being rubbished by these dreadful revolutionaries. Paine said the problem with Burke was that he pitted the plumage, but forgot the dying bird. I thought it was a good argument, but a bad metaphor, because if you start removing plumage for a bird, pretty soon there's not much left. It can't fly, it's not recognisable. And plumage isn't just an external expression of the bird, it's part of what the bird is. And it seemed to me that what was true of flying animals was also true, even more so, of human animals, who not only have their own plumage, their own physical appearance, but they adorn themselves with the plumage of others, the skins of beasts, the flowers of the feathers of peacocks, as we have on the cover of the book. Humans cultivate their identity with the plumage which they acquire. The way they walk, the way they talk, the way they eat, the way they speak, what they wear, all of that is the plumage of humans which constitutes human identity. And it was that I wanted to look at when I started out with this book. And it immediately became clear, at least to me, I hope it's clear to readers as well, that when humans cultivate identity, the first thing they do is cultivate it by association. Robinson Crusoe, alone on his island, couldn't really have much of an identity because there was nobody to associate with. It didn't make much sense to say that he was a part of this group or that group, this church, that religion, that ethnic group, because there was nobody else. But when humans do it, anything they say or constitute as part of their identity is a matter of associating with another group. There. Now, look at them. They're all terribly happy and enthusiastic because they know who they are. And who are they? Well, I haven't the slightest idea, actually. I'm not a football enthusiast, but they're obviously members of supporters of some particular team, and their identity is as members of that team. It would seem to be the winning team as well. The lot on the other side don't look quite so happy. The first way in which human identity, it seems to me, is cultivated is by association. Association, identity, stating, creating your association with another group, another church, another religion, another country, band of brothers. And here we are again. There they are. They're all brothers there. They've all got uniforms. They've all got a few medals. Each one knows who he is as part of the group, part of the association. It's identity by association and solidarity. But all people in the armed forces may indeed have medals, but some have more than others. Marshal Zhukov probably couldn't actually walk with all that, but never mind. If identity by association is a matter of equality, almost immediately, within the association, within the group, there are those who stress their difference, their distinctiveness, but distinctiveness through an excessive version of the identity of the group. It's not that the general tries to present himself as somebody completely different, but simply as a soldier with even more medals. And of course, the higher up you go, the more medals you get. I gather they're even speculating on what kind of medals might be constructed to cover the chest of the new President of the United States. Probably there aren't many medals for not being at home, not going to war because your feet itch, but they could probably construct something. Anyway, more medals. Inequality is the other side of the cultivation of dimension. after the Maoist revolution in China, everybody became a comrade. That gave unity by association, solidarity, and almost immediately inequality set in. Everybody is a comrade, but some comrades are comrade generals, or comrade commissars, or comrade chairmen. A constant tension, in other words, in the cultivation of identity between equality and inequality, between association and distinction. That's one of the themes of the book. There are one or two. This is another one. One of the things that is sometimes suggested is that there is a conflict between two ways of talking about human behaviour, identity or interests. Well, if interests are the raw animal need to stay alive and feed, then on many occasions something else is going on. Because what's happening here is that for whatever reason, these people are risking that material interest, physical survival. Some of them have lost it already. Hegel put it rather nicely, I thought, when he said that in war, the power of association with all overcomes the vanity of temporal goods and concerns. Well, I think temporal goods and concerns are more than vanity, they are actually survival. But what that picture illustrates is the way in which the survival of an identity can take precedence over mere physical survival. After all, if that were not the case, wars would not be possible. Revolutions would never take place. Again and again, instances of actions which are to do with the preservation of an identity, even if that risks the preservation of the person. Material interests are trumped by identity interests. There's another issue that I look at in the book, which is collective identity, national identity. I'll explain why you've got this rather strange picture here. It's sometimes suggested that national identity is a unifying thing, that if you're British or French or Bangladeshi or whatever, that means you must be a certain kind of person. That's why I've got this picture of... scientists will recognise them as fractals, I think. In other words, the pattern is the same at every level. The overall pattern and the pattern of the individual components and the internal structure of the individual components is the same. There are those who see the identity of, particularly of a nation, as being of one particular kind. But look at this. That might be a metaphor for the image of a nation, but you can't really see, but you get the idea. It's made up of a whole series of different pictures. Each of those is a very small picture of an individual. The nature, the character, the identity of a group as large as a nation is composed necessarily of many different parts. And in that sense, there is a disjuncture between national identity and individual identity. If that were not so, just try making a national identity picture like this one out of this lot. Yes, you can't do it. They're all the same, but there's no picture is possible. This is the last picture I want to show you. Because it's a rather nice indication of the power of being able to read, the huge benefit of being able to read. Here's a small ad with a book in the ruins of a library, but the book is there. Open access and open access books, of which this is the first, but I hope the first of many to come out of LSE, is, it seems to me, a truly radical innovation, because it means that anybody, anywhere in the world, at any time, can download and read a book or anything else for free.
Now, when paperbacks cost, what is it? I shouldn't be really saying this with my publishers here, but £19 for a paperback? The difference that makes to millions of students and aspirant students and interesting readers all over the world, the difference between that, which is unaffordable, and totally open access is wonderful. It's democratic publishing. Just imagine if the access which that small boy has to a book was available for all written works to all people in all places at all times. Just imagine. You can see when you start to do so why authoritarian regimes are so hostile to internet cafes. Open access is the most wonderful intervention, which I'm proud and privileged to be the first instance of in LSE. No more than that. I've said enough. I will
Right. I moved out of the way because of the pictures. I now move back. Very good. Now, Shakuntala Banerjee is Associate Professor in the LSE's Department of Media and Communications, and she is going to start the process of the response.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming this evening. Thank you, Rodney, for inviting me to respond to your book. I read it almost as soon as I got it, which, you know, I'm a bookaholic, and that picture appeals to me. And as I was reading through it, I thought what I would do in my response was A, tell you how I felt about it, and B, talk about the ways in which I had taught about and thought about identity differently from the way in which you present it in the book, or the many different ways in which you present it in the book. So as I was going through it, I picked up on all of the things you talked about today, particularly the tension between the in-group and the out-group, and I wanted to think around the term othering, which is something we do when we have an in-group who have a particular identity. So I thought back to the late 1980s and early 1990s when I was training to be a teacher in quite poor schools in southeast London, and the way in which we had a directive which was that education was supposed to make everybody's lives better, and we were all supposed to, whatever they came in as, we had a term we used, and I got a folder full of little children's names, and it said by the end of the 5 years we would have to have value added, and the value we had added would be something which their home identity had not given them. So we were adding something through education to their identity. And of course there were big debates, sociology of education debates within my group as we were doing our PGCEs back then in early 1990s. And it was the beginning of a real shift in education where the burden of transformation of society was being pushed from the state onto individual teachers. And so if children came from council estates or if they came from middle class homes into your classroom, the output was all down to you, everything you did in there. And these were the sort of lectures we started to get around that time. And I still had then, from the Institute of Education and Goldsmiths, a heady mix of socialist education principles and radical education principles, which said that actually, you know, education is transformative because you liberate people's minds and you bring them to a consciousness of their group identity, Paulo Freire. And you allow them to see themselves in this way. But it began to be quite apparent through the 1990s that what we were doing in schools was actually very different from that. It's not that we had a big plot or a big project, but as time to do things outside the narrow confines of a curriculum started to get less and less, what we found was that we were asked to call on people's group identities in a very stereotypical way much, much more quickly. So we were making assumptions. This is what the children who speak a second language need, and this is what we're going to give them. We didn't take a year to find out what they were like or whether they belonged or whether they felt like other children. Or this is what the children who got E at year 9, which is sort of middle school, this is what they're going to be when they're 17. And, you know, I heard head teachers making speeches to that effect. So it was as if your identity was very much determined. Now, any of us who had read sociological literature and critiques of the education system knew that the education system was fighting a losing battle at that point, probably around the time I started thinking about going into university and back again and studying identity in the ivory tower. It was quite a depressing moment. So in a way, what I wanted to say about your book was your book talks about this, but you somehow are very upbeat. You know, you talk about these things and then you come back and you tell another story, and it's not grounded in what I felt as I went through those 10 years. And I want to say, in a funny way, the same thing about the research I now do on identity and politics in India, which is that, you know, I read you talking about groups and violence, but the visceral nature of the violence that takes place when group identities have become so strong and so opposed to each other that one group wants to wipe out another group doesn't come across to me so strongly from the pages of the book. And in a way, perhaps foraying out of the 18th and 19th centuries and into our current and contemporary arena, it is more frightening. So let's just take the example of two things in India, what we call caste atrocities and the current rise of the far right, who happens to be in government. So I think it makes a lot of sense in relation to your book. And through the 1990s, in the late 1990s when I started doing my PhD on cultural images, one of the things I found very quickly was that things that looked banal, things that were everyday and around us, the posters on buses, the scarf that somebody wore, all of these things had symbolic meanings. And that more and more of them were falling into patterns. You wore this color to associate yourself with this party, to associate yourself with that ideology. But nobody was really talking about it. These kinds of advertisements advertised these kinds of things to these kinds of women. But again, nobody was really talking about it. And then suddenly, a government came to power who said loud and clear that unless you do these things, unless you wear these things, and unless you pray in this way, you're no longer a citizen, and you have the right to destroy the other citizens. And it said it in many ways, through individual politicians, it said it in newspapers, it said it by buying up newspapers, which said anything different. At that point, it was almost too late to make people realize that all this banal cultural symbolism around them had been leading in a very particular direction. So these plumage, these markers of identity, and I remember very, very clearly on a fieldwork trip, I was watching a movie with somebody in 2001, and almost every woman in the movie was wearing orange, a bright orange like the cap of that cup. And, you know, I came out with an older friend of mine, and I said, "Oh my God, it's so orange." And orange in India, if you like, is both a religious symbol, you know, it's beautiful, it's lovely, but it's also the color of our fascists. So it has two meanings. And I saw one, and she saw the other. And now that color is everywhere. That is the color, and if I were to show you the riots, the rioters, the people with the swords, the people killing Muslims month in, month out, that is the color stamped everywhere. So what a beautiful woman in a wedding sari in a film wears 25 years ago has a very, very clear identity and cultural significance in relation to now political fascism taking over in the country. And I'll just stop there to say, on that pessimistic note, I read the identity in a lot more pessimistic ways than you do.
Right, very good. Well, there's a great, powerful, challenging response, which is good. Now, our second respondent is Jean Seaton, who is Professor of Media History at the University of Westminster and the official historian of the BBC. Jean.
I don't think I can match that. I thought it was wonderful sort of testimony, and I was very moved by that, so I just wanted to say that Brodney's book has produced that. And it didn't, I understand, I want to tell you, first of all, I just want to tell you an anecdote. So here is the book, and I had it in my hands as I was coming up at Holborn Tube, and I was walking up the stairs, as I usually do, and a set of charming young people with backpacks and beards and woolly jumpers and looking a little bit spaced out gathered round me and said, oh, we've just come from running the alternative experience at the Labour Party conference and we're all about identity politics and can we have a photograph of this book? We need this book now! So confronted with a set of charming young, enthusiastic and exhausted ideologues, I engaged, as I do, in a conversation, and I said, well, I really did think that Ken Loach's speech, which said that the history of the Holocaust was debatable, was an absolutely terrible thing. You could debate the interpretation of the Holocaust, and you could debate why it happened, but you can't debate that it happened. And why didn't you all rise up and shout at him? And I felt that even though I was wearing a red and white dress, that they felt that I was perhaps not entirely one of them. And perhaps I had unnecessarily decided I would put a little principled line between me and them, because they are absolutely charming. But I just wanted to say that if you see on Twitter large numbers of pictures of Rodney's book, and he is you know, held aloft on our left wing riser thing, it's all my fault at Holborn Tube. I wanted to raise two other issues, one of which was that some of the books, so the book is full of, in lots of ways, it's absolutely just my kind of book. It's full of novels and pictures. It's full of the lived experience, actually, of being one of the most privileged people in history. To live in London at this point in the 21st century is to have unparalleled access across the entire range, from music to novels to pictures. And it uses all of those resources, I think, absolutely beautifully, and to some considerable point. I just really wanted to make two sort of reservations. I mean, the first one of which is in a way is exactly the same as yours, is that in a way I'm very interested in those moments when identity fractures to something which is lethal. And it can happen in a blink. I've done, for the BBC, a lot of work in Northern Ireland. And as I said to this gang of young men wearing beards, I said, in Northern Ireland, your identity would have been... You've got beards, so you would have been Catholic. What's your name? One said Frank. So I said, oh, you're Protestant in Northern Ireland. And one said Patrick. So I said, in Northern Ireland, you're Catholic. None of which matters now, but in a moment, in a year, really, between 1971 and 1972, where you lived, what facial hair you had, what your Christian name was, what you ate, what you drank, which... became not a positive identifier, it became something that might well get you killed. And it's those moments of fracture when difference, controlled about but not spoken, allowed, it's those moments when that seems to me very, very interesting. There are moments when there are fractures, and you could always say you could see those fractures coming from a long way, just like you could. But actually, you can't predict those moments. And that takes me to my second point, which is that I'm also very interested in something that Rodney starts to talk about, which is which has got two sides to it, really, which is the what people say in public and what is licensed and legitimated, and whether behind that public, I want to say behind that public face, because one falls into these metaphors that Rodney tells us we shouldn't, but... you know, you're doing it for another reason. Now, you use David Runciman very well. So David Runciman says, actually, the notion of a front and hypocrisy and manipulating people is not to be despised. It's how politics works. But I think that we are in a moment when the public rhetoric of manners, which can be something which conceals hidden nastinesses which are going to break out. But look what happens when the public rhetoric of manners shifts decisively. And it occurred to me that I'd always been interested in the BBC because what it does is take how the public thinks and talks. And in a rather... of course it doesn't always get this right... mostly gets it wrong, but nevertheless the intention is to shift and talk about everything. So Now, you have to talk about all everything because you're there to represent everybody. But you try and do that in the language of that which is polite and proper. And that the notion of the argument, which the BBC, I think, is abandoning, but that's another issue, which is it's not what I believe. What I believe doesn't... You know, you can listen to what I believe, but we will hold a circle open in a rather polite way for us to have disagreements within. And that the role of the journalist or interrogator is to ask difficult questions. That seems to me so profoundly important because it's what failed to happen in India. It's absolutely what failed to happen in India. And in a way, it's a sham. I mean, you know, in a way, it's about being polite. In a way, it's about good manners. Bring on good manners, is what I would say. Bring on hypocritical, false, good manners. Because it's good manners that, as it were, keep the public space one in which differences can be listened to, attended to, heard, and yet, in a sense, turned into new politics. So I thought that Rodney's book raised all sorts of fantastically interesting things. And what I thought I was going to say, and I'm not going to really say that, is that online, that difference between the public and the private has been collapsed. And the consequences of that collapse... last year I did quite a lot of work, which then the journal didn't like, because it was a journal run by men, on anorexia websites, because I didn't want to talk about politics. So I thought I'd do anorexia, but of course the men wanted to talk about politics, so they cut all the stuff on anorexia, which is not a usual gene sort of thing to say, but it was noticeable that instead... So if I'd have talked about politics, they'd have left it in, but because I was talking about anorexia, they thought it was about girls, so they cut it out. But it's the same thing. If you look at anorexia websites, it's very, very... You're very, very close. You're two clicks away to a very extreme anorexia supporting website. The life that's lived on those is both in public and in private. And whether people have a private behind the public they live, I really don't know. So I think we're in an area of... I think we really are in an era of radical shifts around all of this stuff. And not many of them... They may turn out fine. And I was happy for Rodney's exploration, which I agree was positive. But it's those... I think we are in a quite scary moment when some expectations are shifting really dramatically. And up with hypocritical politeness is my general mission. With a bit of telling young people with beards what they don't want to hear.
Thank you very much for party political broadcast on behalf of the hypocritical forces. The debate. There's another book to be written about the inevitability, and certainly the the importance of, or the difficulty of everybody ever, if you only ever told the truth, and how that would end badly. But that's for another day.
Yeah.
Right, now, Rodney, would you like to respond to the, I wouldn't say accusation, that's too strong, but the observation that you're perhaps a bit Panglossian in your interpretation of plumage and identity?
The observation is not too strong, but it is within the circle.
Well, I was using Jean's breakthrough.
Possible. I mean, what struck me about what Chuck and Tyler were saying was that, yes, I absolutely agree. And the really rather certainly bewildering and to some extent depressing feature about shared identities is that they can work in all kinds of different ways. That you can find easily instances of people whose identity is sustained by the existence of other people who are not like them. One of the things I talk about briefly in the book is the development of popularly accessible motor cars. Between the last two wars, in the 1920s, when motor cars were spun, things were bought and used, sports cars were very expensive. And when one firm started producing what looked like a sports car, sounded like a sports car, went like a sports car, but didn't cost like a sports car, a lot of people in sort of automobile association circles were outraged by this, because this was people getting above themselves. And really, the whole point of having an expensive sports car is that you could drive past people who hadn't got one. And certainly one can find many instances of this, even in religious or ethnic diversity. We've just come back from Johannesburg. Now, before the end of apartheid, there was quite clearly a sense, it seems to me, in which members, say, of the Dutch Reformed Church were actually sustained in their belief about their particular character by the fact that there were those who literally wouldn't be seen dead or allowed in their church because they were not white, they were black. Some instances of extreme identity difference are deliberately sustained by the privileged to maintain their sense of privilege. In other circumstances, exactly the same thing may challenge them so that they feel the need modestly to reform or improve others, radically to expel them, or even more radically to murder them. And very often it's not easy to distinguish between one instance of the consequences of that cultural difference, identity difference, and another. I mean, in one sense, I'm as pessimistic as you are, but doubly so, because it is sometimes baffling to say, well, why, if you wear red braces, are you simply thought to be a bit of a wag? But if you wear a red T-shirt at the wrong football match, you get your head kicked in.
But probably doesn't this take us, though, into the, and perhaps all of us, the issue which I think has been already referred to, which is the identity and the way it's expressed through dress or kind of music or the way you perform the music or the iconography that you adopt, it depends where it leads, isn't it? If it's used for one purpose, it can be 100% benign.
Yes.
And if it's used for another, it can lead to the worst things that have ever happened in the world. And you only have to say it like that to see how, you know, it can be very, and that is a sort of paradox. Yeah. And the orange, the point about orange, I think, was a very beautiful way of putting it. Mm. So it is about where it takes us, isn't it, rather than what.
You might say, I've often thought that a good essay would be me and the Union Jack, because over my life, it's been expropriated by the right, and then actually Blair brought it back, so it was all right, you could be me and be quite like the Union Jack. And now I suspect it's, you know, now the Scots don't want it and it's also gone off. So that single thing, the Union Jack, over our lives, it's the politics of its meaning and who owned it has been wrested away from us, even though it's a national. So it's not a stable thing.
And there are, I mean, something like, I mean, it's a poem turned into a hymn, Jerusalem. I've always struck me as a piece of art, a piece of literature, which is, frankly, adopted by people with different views, pointing in different directions, isn't it?
Yes.
And Blair Wright.
Yes.
Yes.
I'd like to respond to this discussion or what Rodney said in response to what you said.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with you. I just feel that after all the things we know and all the books that have been written, and there have been utterly brilliant books written, which sort of you call on, you draw on some of that work, some of Pierre Bourdieu, and you know, Benedict Anderson's work on identity in newspapers. And once we know these things, we can't unknow them, and so we can't then take on the position of a considered naivete about cultural symbols, which might or might not lead somewhere. Now, the thing that I notice a lot in my work, and I beg pardon of the British people here, but people are very knowledgeable about what an incendiary symbol might mean in the British context, but they're not so knowledgeable about what it might mean in the South African context or in the Indian context. So what tends to happen, and I see this a lot, I teach a course in which we talk a lot about this thing called Orientalism, is that everyone here goes, oh no, that's a vicious, dangerous pit bull terrier, and a man with a, you know, with his baton out and the flag, and the English flag. We don't like those kind of people here because we understand what they symbolise. But oh, look at these gorgeous colours on the bank of the Ganges in India.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. And what they don't see is A, the exclusions. Mm. So no Muslims, no women, poor children cropped out of the photo. Mm-hmm. And I had a very good example of this. A very lovely person who was on one of my courses 5 years ago constantly sends me her journalistic photographs and sent me her Flickr account saying, these are the photos that are going to be published. And they were 25 pictures, and she called them the real India, her journey through the real India. And in almost every single one, and there was one woman in 20 photographs. And yeah, we have a population problem. You know, there are fewer women because women are killed off, but not that stark yet. And there was absolutely nothing which connoted Christians or Muslims.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
196 million Muslims. You'd think, you know, larger than four European countries. You think you might have got one in 20 photographs. So the absences in terms of how one looks at the plumage of others, mm-hmm. where one doesn't actually know the political background,
yeah.
are very stark to me. And yet we pronounce judgment. The BBC pronounces, you know, a reporter will go and do a two-minute, you know, talk about the pulling down of a mosque or this or that. Whether we can actually do that in 2 minutes or not is a huge, huge issue.
This is a funny thing. I mean, you're really talking about our ignorance.
Yes.
So I'd rather defend that at least the BBC goes there. I'd rather get...
You'd rather they went there than didn't go there.
Yes, because you're not going to get any more intelligent if nobody goes. I think our ignorance is and our blundering. I mean, it's just like we're always, we all blunder about in other people's realities. I mean, Rodney's got a that's true.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
I really seriously, theoretically, politically and everything, don't believe that the only people that can have experiences are people that have experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So art entirely depends on the capacity to take other experiences and turn them into something. And so does most knowledge. It's flawed, but I mean, so I don't believe... Because I think that kind of essentialism about experience is also growing and is really dangerous, actually. I mean, Beveridge did his best to understand what was happening to working class employment and he did it even though he didn't come from there, and he did it to the great advantage of those that did. So I'm a great believer in that standing. I do actually believe in the standing, but of course we are ignorant. There's a wonderful phrase in Rodney's book, which is identity wars, which I shall immediately use, because I think it is the way in which identities are weaponized. And I'm surprised we're not all kneeling at the moment, given what's going on today in America. You just, everybody has to kneel, because then you say this isn't just a... you're into the politics of symbols and in a very visual world. So I think that's the other thing you might just finally say. We are certainly living in a world which is sort of moving from the word, the hat, to the image. Then all of this matters more, which is why politicians are all getting younger and thinner, apart from Donald Trump. I mean, he's the exception to the rule, but politicians are getting younger and thinner because that's... You couldn't be Harold Wilson. I mean, even Jeremy Corbyn's got thinner, and he's wearing a smarter suit.
Just up a bit.
Yeah, so I think the politics of symbols in a visual world is more alarming and more important. So in that sense, you're onto. There is another issue. This is the currency that mostly people are fumbling around with, but the people who weaponize it. Weaponize it very effectively.
Okay, I'm going to stand over here, not because I want to dominate speakers, but because I can't see with the light shining in my eyes, so forgive me leaving you. Now, feel free, I know who you are, but feel free to say if you'd like to who you are and Go for it.
My name's Mike Cushman.
There's a mic coming to Mike.
Let's try to get into the middle of some of these things. One thing that struck me was we haven't made enough distinction between willingly adopted plumage and imposed labels. Those plumages we adopt in order to identify ourselves with a group, whether it's a red shirt or a, of course it should be for Arsenal rather than a blue shirt for Chelsea, which we are always abhor, versus the imposed labels, often ethnic ones, and I'm not going to run through them, but we can imagine what they are, or class ones. Chavs, for instance, I mean, Owen Jones was very good about describing how the language of chav has been used to demonise the poor, or, as I would often said, looking the other way, the toffs. This is a way of labelling, to exclude and differentiate and to impose my meaning of the world on others. And got that dichotomy. I think I want to go back a little to Ken Loach, because I didn't hear everything that Ken said because I was responsible for stewarding the meeting and my attention was often distracted in a difficult task. But I think it's important to say that Ken wasn't advocating Holocaust denial. What he was testing was the limits of the shibboleths of polite conversation, that language that enables you to be a part of polite civilization. And we can contrast Holocaust denial, which I would challenge quite vigorously if I ever see it, which threatens me as someone of Jewish origin, from the tolerance on the BBC and everywhere else of climate change denial, which threatens every single person in this room, and why one is to be totally abhorred and the other is to be given a platform, is an interesting question.
Okay. Right, Rodney, would you want to respond to the point about labels?
Yes, I mean, it's... I started off by saying, yes, that humans are like birds, but they actually choose their own plumage. But you're absolutely right that for some humans, the plumage is chosen for them.
Yeah.
And that is certainly a part of... It's one of the tactics for maintaining dominance or privilege. There's a whole history, for instance, of... the legal regulation of clothing, sumptuary laws. You can only wear red heels before the French Revolution if you're in the aristocracy. You're regarded with extreme displeasure in other societies if you dress out of class. You're getting above yourself. There's a nice moment in Wesker's Chips with Everything, where the officers, who are posh and come from good schools, are seeking to liven up the conscripts, who are not. And they clearly regard rock and roll as something vulgar and appalling, and therefore deliberately encourage the troops to do this. They don't, of course. Because there's a posh renegade in there who's got some Benjamin Britten, which he gets them all to sing about ditties or spring or something, which is regarded as quite revolutionary. But you're absolutely right. That one of the ways of maintaining dominance is to control the plumage of those you dominate in a way which it doesn't express their inferiority. It is part of it. I mean, that's one of the things that I want to say again and again, that plumage is not an expression of something soul and inside. It's who people are all these various things. They are composed by their plumage, not expressed by their plumage. But absolutely right.
But again and again, it does trigger these days, I mean, you know, the question of whether sports people can wear particular symbols at matches, whether people of particular race or religion or ethnicity can wear particular clothes when they're doing particular jobs. I mean, the state is now involved in all countries, I'm guessing, in regulating some of the desired, although actually not always desired, some of the imagined impacts of plumage. I mean, is that the way in which identity is described by wearing or attributing particular meanings to what you wear?
Well, yes.
I'm happy to respond. I know Jean will want to respond, definitely. I completely agree. I mean, we should be thinking about identity which is imposed and identity which is chosen, but let's complicate it even more than that, because there are middle grounds within both those types of identities, and I think this is where we run into a problem, because we assume that identities that are imposed, and, you know, I'm thinking of yellow stars and serial numbers here, we assume that identities that are imposed are necessarily thrown off by the people onto whom they are imposed.
No, absolutely.
And that agency, to be an agentic citizen or human being, you would have to throw off this imposed identity and claim another one. But I did a lot of work on slavery when I was teaching, and we started to ask the question of, at what point does a human being who has been born into serfdom or slavery start to discover that they are a person, a human being, and a subject? At what point do they begin to discover that? And actually, even today, I mean, if you go into some very rural tribal areas in India where identities have been imposed by the state, people claim the imposed identity. Mm. So there are middle grounds where an imposed identity has become the only identity into which someone has been born, and caste being one of those. And it's very difficult to then tear apart what is imposed and what is claimed. So actually, agency is contaminated at many different levels. The claiming cannot be seen as a free claiming, nor the imposition as only imposition any longer. And the second thing I want to talk about was women, and we haven't really talked about women very much. I noticed a sort of, for me, a gap. There's a lot of feminist work on identity. Mm-hmm. It wasn't there as much as I would have liked to see it. But what I wanted to say about women was that nowadays, often many, many young women in the post-feminist age or the backlash against feminism, many young women will say really feminist things in a big classroom, and then someone will go, "You're a feminist," and they'll go, "No, I'm not." Yes. You know, so they actually rage on and throw off that label, which is a positive identity, but to them, which is a label, which is an abusive term. And they don't see it as a positive identity anymore. And that's a really interesting shift in culture and history, which the media has a lot to answer for.
Jean, do you want to say anything
else? No, let's get more people.
Okay, all right, if you're full going. Okay, very good.
I haven't had the... Sebastian Balfour, an ex-colleague, well, actually still a colleague, we're both emeritus, in the government department. I haven't had the great pleasure of reading Rodney's book. I'm just curious that in all the discussion we've had so far, the concept of narrative has not emerged, because I thought that was central. Of course, narrative and the plumage is part of the narrative, I imagine, but the links between narrative and plumage have not really emerged in any of our discussion. And surely, narrative story, because it's perhaps an overused word now, is essential in the construction of identity, not just of the individual. You know, I have my story, which I keep inventing as I go along, because national identity is also a question of invention. And I'm very conscious of that national identity in the case of Catalonia and Spain, which I'm following closely at the moment. And so, you know, what are the links between narrative and plumage? To what extent is plumage also a reflection of stories that people have told about collective identities?
So they are parallel concepts, but do they have links?
Yes, I think they do. And in fact, there's a very interesting... I came across this argument in a piece by James Meek, and I don't know if it's his idea, but I was fascinated by it. And he was talking about immigration. And he said that the kind of immigration with which we are familiar, that we'll talk about, is geographical immigration. But what happens there is that a group of people come to another place
and they feel insecure. And in order to cultivate some sense of security, they develop a narrative of what it was like in the old place, the old country. And this narrative is always simplified. New Haven, New England, New Hampshire. But he said there's another kind of immigration, and that is temporal immigration. Not moving through space, but moving through time. And that one of the things that you see in countries like this one now is groups of people who suddenly find themselves in what seems to them a strange land. And so they develop a story of what the old country was like. But the old country is sort of cod Orwell. Maiden aunts cycling to church through the morning mists for early morning communion, no Polish grocers, all of that sort of thing. And there are stories there, but stories are always simplifications. I mean, a novel, a film, a play is always an abbreviation and an artificial cutting off of the actual complexities of life. So, yes, certainly stories. I wanted to come back on something quite different, actually, but it relates to the regulation clothing. I mean, what the most evident instance of that, I would have thought, and of the complete flexibility of what this may mean, is the debate about what women may wear on their heads or their faces across Europe, and attempts to legislate on that or not legislate on that, and to see it as either an imposition by somebody on a dominated sex, or as an exercise of free choice by free male citizens, or a range of positions on that. But we have plenty of state regulation of clothing quite close to home.
I think I can think of an example, though, of a link between the two, when France had banned certain clothing for Muslim women, and the then Home Secretary, I think he was made of a junior Home Office Minister, Damien Green, now the Deputy Prime Minister, was asked, do you think Britain should do that? He replied, no, I don't think telling people what to wear is very British. Now, you can argue with all of this, but I'm just saying that's probably how he replied. And it does link together a narrative, your sense, Sebastian, of a narrative with the plumage and symbol of what, I mean, I'm sure everybody can think of better ones and less banal ones than I've just managed, but so there must be thought through links, I bet there are. Jean?
Well, I was just going to say, I think that over the last 30 years, the notion of identity has resolved itself into being the identity of minorities. One of the things that has damagingly completely forgotten is that majorities also have identities.
Mm.
And so there's been a lot of concern around minorities. That's absolutely right, and the sort of flexibility. But they're not the only cultures, as it were. And majorities... So, again, this is a rather unfashionable thing to say, I know that, but I think that we have no story to tell. We began to develop a story, it's called multiculturalism, which is everything was equal, which had toleration but no principles in a funny kind of way. So what don't we tolerate? What is it? It's not the British way. And we just, there's now a vacuum. Nobody knows what, there is no, at the moment, there is no story which resolves the, as far as one can see, the hideous sentimentality of the British majority. I mean, there's a very interesting thing. You might say that's another interesting thing about identity, which it is very often sentimental, not historic. You know, so what you do is you look back. You don't remember. You remember Trump Doy. You remember an emotionally sentimentalized version of something that used to be meaningful, as it were, and then that becomes dangerous. So I think identity is absolutely an issue, but people are very frightened to talk about those how we now relate majorities and minorities. We don't actually have a story about that at the moment, because we did have a story, and now
it doesn't feel as if it kind of works. And that feels to me, and the only other thing that comes to me was that Trevor Phillips actually has a very interesting paper somewhere in which he says that when you look at immigrant groups and how they have moved through different societies, then it turns out that some are very quite closed and have very strong identity, which means they don't blend, and other ones are too open and as it were, dissolve too quickly. And that's a kind of quite interesting, you need the right amount of identity in order to move through a society, and that's how do we facilitate understanding the right amount of identity. Seems to be an interesting issue.
I've got about 50 things that I want to say in
go
response
for it.
To your narrative. I mean, talking about narrative to a communication scholar is just, it's a gift, right? I would have loved to drag you off on narrative, metaphor, etc., etc. I just thought I'd stick closer to the identity question, but I've got two things to say, one in response to Jean and one in response to you. When I said we can't have a considered naivete about symbols and signs,
yes.
What I meant was we have to start reading the narrative, and
yes.
We have to start reading it as something that is being deployed strategically and deliberately
it's
by
weaponized.
Groups of people.
It's weaponized,
if you like, but long, long, long before it starts to have that ripple effect in which people begin to recognize it for what it is. Okay, I'll take you out of the British context, where apparently the majority have no story, though as an ethnic minority, I feel quite differently, to India, where there is only the majority story, and Indonesia and Malaysia, where the majority stories have become so powerful that the only other option, the only other story which anyone can tell, is that of old-fashioned anti-colonial nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
But even the old-fashioned anti-colonial nationalism, which used to bind together minorities and majorities in places like Indonesia, India and Malaysia, has now been taken over by the majority as their thing. So there is literally no space for the identity of, but for the lives of minorities in those places. So if you want a template for what might happen if the majority tells a story, and the story is never just a narrative, it's often a myth, it's often a lie, it's then a history and then a textbook, what happens is that, and it's very clear to see it's playing out on televisions and in mobs.
I would want to qualify the idea of a majority here, if one looks at attempts to create a dominant narrative or a uniform national identity, it may appeal to the majority, but I don't think precisely the deliberate mobilisation, arming of that collective identity is not usually the action of a majority, it's the action of a minority, for whom the majority are
fools.
Real or imaginary stock
troops.
Fools.
I get that.
If you look at the debate in this country over the European Union, what happens? No,
you have to pay a fine for being the first person to mention it.
Yes!
The Daily Mail is not a representative of the majority. But it's very happy.
It's manipulative.
The judges are the enemies of the people, which is a bit like the diners in the Ritz grill, allegedly after the 1945 general election. Yeah. But this is terrible. They've elected a Labour government, and the country will never stand.
It's far worse than that. It's far worse than that.
It's very. People who talk about the majority. This is what the people want. This is what the people have decided. Yes, it may well be manipulative, but it's not an expression of a genuine sort of spontaneous indigenous popular identity, I think.
Well, neither is minority identity.
No,
it's always a minority within the minority whose identity then gets picked up as somehow the minority identity. So we have to make that distinction in all camps.
Oh, yes.
Okay, this is a rich scene, so let's... Yes, please, sir.
Paul McGrill, Pax Christian, Peace News. Touching on the French attitude to, you're talking about what a nation or locality prohibiting external plumage. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that. I think it's because if people are not wearing indicators of their tribe, it's much easier for people to accept each other without prejudgments. I mean, there's a reason why after football matches, pubs have no colours. Now, I was born in a certain place, and I went to certain schools, and I followed a particular spiritual tradition. But I don't want to show the world that. That's a private thing. So if you're wearing a cross or a Star of David, or your face is veiled, I'm going to have presuppositions about you, and there's no need for that. I'd rather find out about you through discussion. And I think what the French are saying is, don't place these difficulties in the civic domain. Let people judge each other entirely upon who they are. I mean, I saw someone this summer.
I think the on the religions that have sort of stripped themselves of iconography and identifiers, but even by doing that, create an alternative identifier, which is, Calvin, I mean, Protestantism, Calvinism, all of that has its origin. Quakers, definitely, a sort of counter, moving as far away as possible, but in doing so, coming out with their own separate unicorn.
Yes.
Isn't it? I mean, forgive me, I'm sorry, I'm on the chair.
The Jesuits no longer wear habits because they don't want to, as it were, separate themselves and be seen as different from the others.
Anyway, they want to be seen as something, though.
No, not until they know. No.
They want to be seen as like this group of people or that group of people.
No,
whatever you wear, it looks like something.
I'm not wearing a slogan. What, if I go into a cafe and someone's got a momentum shirt, I don't want to sit at that table. Whereas if he wasn't or she wasn't wearing that political slogan, I could converse. I could enter into engagement with that person.
Sure, I used to know lots of quite senior. This is completely a random observation. We used to know two quite senior civil servants, one of whom was very tiny, who had grown beards during Mrs. Thatcher's period, because that was their. They were basically opposing her.
Protest. Yeah.
They both became permanent secretaries, and they used to occasionally do the equivalent of high five at each other, because they'd grown beards. As a civil service way of saying, actually, we're not yours. So that's just it's a kind of interesting little.
Did others
realise? All the other civil servants realised, but Mrs. Thatcher never quite could pin it down.
I wonder whether they. He's saying, hey, he's got to be, he must be different. I've got to watch out for this. Whereas it might have been quite simple. In other words, you're saying that was plumage. In this case, it was, seemingly, as you know. But it might have been just, I feel like wearing a beard. And in other words, the plumage may not be so important. I mean, a lot of the discussion, I think, today that we had, that you had, is not about plumage, it's about identity. Where plumage, one way or another, isn't important. Sorry, I seem to be talking longer than just an interjection.
It's all right.
But it does seem that I'm hoping in the book, Rodney, you do this, that you actually make a difference between kinds of privilege. You talked about Wesker. There's a character in that play who's called Smilers, or Smiler, because he smiles all the time. He can't get it off his face.
Yeah.
And the army, the generals or colonels or whatever they are, they really don't like him for that, because he always seems to be smiling at them. So you could say, well, it's kind of foolish, but, well, he can't avoid it. So it's not as if he's opted for that plumage. And the second thing is, well, the plumage may not actually mean, it would have to be defined what that plumage actually means.
Well, I mean, I understand where you're coming from. I profoundly disagree with you, partly because I think the whole notion of clothing is just a side issue we've been led off on and it is a sort of plumage, but on the other hand, try telling a woman, pretend not to be a woman in a boardroom of men. You know, she can dress up in whatever she wants, and even after the Chinese Revolution, when she was wearing blue overalls, she was still bringing up the children and working in the fields and being a member of the party. So, you know, women's work didn't stop just because we wore all exactly the same clothing. And on a much, much grimmer note, there are many countries in which people look exactly the same on the outside in how they dress. You can address them in whatever way you want, but during a riot, they'll be asked to drop their trousers so that they can be checked whether they're circumcised or not. So we need to be aware that at those moments that we were talking about, when identity suddenly comes to the fore, whether you can have a conversation with someone because they don't have a slogan on their T-shirt doesn't matter, but whether something is in your soul, on your body, in your skin is what really matters. And we haven't really touched enough on what is not plumage, what is not chosen nor awarded, but what is us, born as we are.
And in fairness, I think we are building up a picture this evening that there are, well, plumage is an attribute that is important. There are others, narrative is another, which can run together. They don't subsume each other, they can run alongside and be linked, I think. Anyway, more points from the... Yes, please. Microphone.
Thanks. Hello, Rose. Many years ago, I was in China during the Cultural Revolution, and my initial thought was, my God, they're all dressed in navy blue. But then I began to notice much more interesting things, like, and also the peasants who were despised, because they wore jolly clothes. But then, looking among the rest, I began to notice buttons. Now, workers wore buttons which were just like what I would call large trouser buttons. When you looked at other groups, you saw that they wore braided buttons, much prettier. Now, these were the elite, the one member I met of what would we call elsewhere the Comintern, and then the intellectuals. Now, the political elite, I could tell from the intellectual elite, I'm being really wild here, they had beautiful haircuts. So gradually, when I was in a room of allegedly all the same comrades, I could actually see in their clothes roughly which they were likely to be. And I thought, this is incredible. But, wandering around, it was quite unlike Russia, you were allowed to wander anywhere. Wandering around, one saw these things and thought, gosh, this is a subtle differentiation going on here. But then I also thought, but actually, a beautiful haircut, beautiful things are beautiful. And who sees these? So I felt there were many more things going on. I mean, I appreciate absolutely your point about the clothes being sort of trivial. But when you see millions and millions and millions of people all wearing navy blue, you do start looking at them and you look in a much more curious way.
I just feel overwhelmed by saying I don't think clothes are trivial. I mean, it's a huge industry and young women spend the most amazing amount of time involved in Star Wars and considering how they look. I mean, it is that we live in a young men as well. We live in actually a lookist society, and I don't think it's either industrially trivial or the things that are going on within clothes. I never have thought, but to say that clothes are trivial
only in relation to skin. Not
yes.
In relation to anything else.
Yes, okay. I completely take your... But you are absolutely... Of course one takes one's point about that fracture in which it doesn't matter how you try and pass, you will be outed. That's what you're really saying.
Rodney talks about being able to take something off and put it on.
But you can't... There are things you
there
can't...
There are things... I was just saying that as women, as people of colour, we can't take it off and put it on.
But there are other biological things that you can't get rid of, like an identical twin. But there are a few people who hate the parents of identical twins who dress them the same, who hate them more than I do. This seems to be absolute denial of those children's individuality. And, I know sundry geneticists who feel exactly the same way, that this tiny biological difference is being forced on these children all day and every day. And as for identical twins, I mean, it's just intolerable. Anyway, that's just...
Okay, excellent, thank you. And the back.
you. Malcolm Gillies. I'd like to ask you a question about our author, who has at one stage in his life been an opera critic. And my question is about plumage in the unreal world, in a world which is designed largely to be fictional, though can tell some more essential truths than any fact could ever do. Do you talk in the book about plumage in creative worlds, or are you mainly grounded in a socio-political world?
I do mention, in order to avoid it, the metaphor of stages and masks. So I don't talk about the creative world in the sense in which you're talking about creation. I do talk about why I'm not using the idea, which some people do play with. Dave Runson mentioned, all the world's a stage and we're all players. Why I don't like that idea is because we are players. So what you see is not the real we. The inside there's something which is the real person, and then there's all of this out there, which leads to wonderful jokes about, you can't take him seriously because deep down he's superficial. Masks and theatre, to try and give your narrative of human life in terms of that sort of metaphor, I think that he dodges the issue. But if everything is a play, is performance, then what is this thing inside, which apparently is the essential we, if you don't happen to believe in souls? So I don't. It's the short answer, but you have the long one as well.
Do you think he should have done? Do you think Rodney's got it wrong by excluding theatre and the entire creation of artifice to express ideas, the use of artifice to express ideas, which is then borrowed by the non-theatrical world, after all?
Well, you could go even deeper and quote Wagner, who would say that so many of his operas were in fact the music made manifest. It was an invisible thing, which was the essential truth, pushed out into something more, he did use the word trivial, because it had to take on words, and with that some idea of meaning, and also the imagery, including all of this, what people were wearing on stage. And so, yeah, I think you're probably wise to avoid it, because you can go into many of those deepest levels, and in fact Wagner would argue that the most essential truth was necessarily in something that was not visual and was not verbal. It was in something that was in fact of the sounded world, and that alone. In which case, the flummery of the plumage on the stage, which often, by the way, becomes about half of the review of many opera critics, though I'm sure not our author, that gets into a completely different view about what essential truths and human truths are about. So it was probably well avoided in this case.
Well, a tangential answer to your question, which is that although I don't talk about opera or the stage or film, I draw on them quite a lot because I think they provide all kinds of interesting insights into what's going on. King Lear, for instance, a dog's bay, robes and fur gowns, hide all, a dog's obeyed in office. Now, what is he saying there? It looks as though he might be saying that the reality is the dog. And that robes and furred gowns on a villain hide the fact that there's a real villain. But I think he's also saying that actually the robes and furred gowns are important, because they are what makes the thing work. They are the event in the real world. So there are all kinds of things to be learned from. I think one of the things I say somewhere in the book is that there is not an absolute distinction between what we think of as creative narratives and academic narratives. It's much more like a broad spectrum, and at one end there is an extreme version of the purely creative and imaginary, and at the other end there is the purely academic and objective. But actually,
each has many things to say about the other, and I've done so, draw on created things. Though, in view of what you said about music and Wagner, not only Wagner who talks like that, I mean, Benjamin Britten had a similar view of music. But really, the only response to that is if these are truths and which are only musically expressed, then we shouldn't be writing musical criticism at all. We should be singing.
Okay, I'll take this. Yes, here first, because I'll come back to you later. Next.
Thank you. My name is Gloria. I'm not an academic at all, but I'm always very interested in the way people present themselves and what signals they're trying to give out and how often they actually fail to achieve what they want to. I remember in the 70s when I was working in community education, there were a whole group of us and some of them would try and show that they were in touch with the working class by wearing headbands, looking scruffy, and having long hair. You will remember this then, wouldn't you? Do you remember there was a guy who wore sort of a red Indian headband? I've forgotten his name. And you know, they go around these housing estates. And the working class people who lived there looked down on them. They were dirty, they were disgusting, and what on earth were they trying to do, you know? But since then, I've changed my career, and for the last 30 years, I've been working helping people find relationships with people to love, find partners for life. I've been working in the dating industry, basically. Now, what I have discovered, because we have so much choice of identity these days with fashion and magazines and stuff being thrown at us, and people get stuck in something they feel safe with but isn't expressing who they really want to be. So part of my job has been to try and help them loosen up and find out, you know, what they would enjoy wearing and what would give out the right kind of signals to the kind of person they want to attract. Because so often they're putting people off by doing all the wrong things, you know. So that's another dimension to throw in.
It's wonderful.
All right, that's my
very good, thank you. Well, I think we've established beyond peradventure that plumage matters.
It's so enjoyable.
And we'll take one final contribution from the front.
David Spence. Just to follow on this thing about defining what plumage is, the plumage that people have been talking about mainly is plumage you can see. It's clothing or it's skin level or whatever. And I wonder if in the book you talk about plumage that you can't see, for example, the plumage of diplomacy, where you might think that diplomats have a special language for describing things which enables them not to say what they think, to only say what their government tells them to.
I think Jean was pointing out, Jean's remark at the very beginning of the evening about hypocrisy took us slightly into that world, wasn't it? Which is the capacity to convey not exactly the thing you mean, whilst not failing fully to convey something. I think that's what diplomacy is often. Is that right, Jean?
Yes, I think, yes.
What I meant was, I mean, I wanted to bring it back to this kind of definition of what we mean by plumage.
Well, clearly you can hear not just music, but language.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, do you look at things like that, like diplomats, for example?
Shibboleth. Yeah. I mean, the way you pronounce things can be absolutely fatal.
There's also a very moving passage where you talk about how you might torture somebody whom you knew with... Well, it's very
quick.
You remember?
Yes, I do, absolutely.
Better tell Rodney, because he...
How you might, someone whose plumage is simply their belief.
Yes.
But you know what their belief is.
Yes, so you...
And you violate it in front of them.
Yeah.
And so that's not plumage you can see. It's something you know about somebody and their belief and their values. So I know your book better than you do.
I said the last point. We'll have one final point from the back.
Who's the final point?
Yes, sorry. if I can put it this way, the man in the red and black shirt, for want of a better way of identifying.
John Pinchbeck. Rod, I'd like to ask you about the book itself, the production. Behind you on the screen is your last photograph. And I've been imagining, as you ask us to imagine, what this world would be like if everyone at any time and anywhere could have access to the book, open access. And I wanted to say, firstly, congratulations on writing the first book to come out of here on this basis, but also to ask you whether, like me, you are somewhat fearful of open access.
Can I just say, this is a world in which there's no Orwell, because he doesn't work for an institution which pays him a salary. He depends on making money from writing. So you are talking about a world in which writers have to be employed by other people in a different kind of way. That may not make them the most independent of souls. Look at journalists. So, sorry, that's my...
Okay, can I go and ask my question? Do you, like me, have some fears of open access? I speak as someone who, when I read your book, and I will read it, I'll have to buy it because I can't read a book on a screen. The document is too long, and I struggle. Maybe I'm not alone in this room in struggling with reading books on screens. Perhaps as evolution develops the eye and mind and so on of the human race, we'll get to be able to do it more readily, but I struggle. And other people of my age I know do also. The other thing is, I'm a great fan of newspapers, and The Guardian is getting thinner and thinner every week.
Been given away.
And that's largely because it's devoted most of its resources, or more of its resources, to its online presence. And facing the reality that it's hard to sell newspapers. So although I do congratulate you, I do have some reservations about open access. Even assuming, to imagine your hypothesis, that everyone in the world at any time and any place has a computer and a signal to read it.
Let's just take very briefly, because I think all of our panel will want to... It's an interesting question. It's partly related, it's related obviously to the evening in the sense that the book is open access. It may not be exactly the core of the evening, but it's nevertheless an interesting point. So I'm going to ask all of our panel, from starting with Jean, moving towards me, to say, Jean, do you want to say a word?
I think there is a very... there is a big problem about the notion that stuff that is given away free is actually free. Rodney lives. The Guardian has made a catastrophic error in giving away stuff. Absolutely catastrophic. Somebody will come up with some new model for journalism, but journalism costs because people need insurance, they need defence, they need their children to have supper. Look at what is happening to journalism in societies where journalists get killed. In India, journalism has become incredibly kowtowed. So I think, sadly, there is a fantastic problem with this model. And I run the Orwell Foundation. All I said was that Orwell was genuinely... he could live independently on writing, not very well. And the only things that people that make enough money to live on writing now are people who are extremely successful. So I think be careful for what you want, I'm afraid, is my rather...
Second time?
I couldn't put it better than that. I mean, you wouldn't have had Charles Dickens, who was waiting because the debt collectors were going to take him to prison if he'd had to do it. If he'd had to compete, I wouldn't say he'd have to do it open access. If he'd had to compete with open access.
Yeah.
And of course, what happened to The Guardian and what happened to lots of other very good papers was that they were competing with free papers. And I was researching young news audiences and just watching people picking things up off the tube. And they would say, well, why would you buy something if you can get it for free?
Because news
is
very expensive.
But what that news was, dare I say, drivel in some cases, was actually also having a very strong political effect in relation to identity.
Yes.
So actually what you read becomes part of your identity.
Absolutely.
Which is not to say that I don't think that it's good to have free and open access things for people who need it. So, but I think it's about...
So we're very keen on Rodney's book being free and open access.
Yeah,
we think that's a wonderful innovation.
Well, it's can pay, should pay.
And the publishers are in the audience.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Can
I just want to make a very good point about the difference
difference between when we talk about open access.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
yeah.
there's a huge difference between journalists needing to be paid. Absolutely, that. I think in our world, it's about publicly funded research that's then locked
yes.
away,
mm-hmm.
yeah. and publishers making millions and millions and millions of dollars. Like, does anyone have any idea how much library subscriptions to journals that Elsevier widely cost?
Yeah.
And that is publicly funded money going into this.
No, no. I mean, if you tick on OUPs, mistakenly, I did an article and I ticked because I thought I ticked the thing that said I wanted to go to open access because it had stuff about my husband in it. Mm. And the bill came back, which was £4,000. I'd seen four and I thought it was 400. So they were going to charge me £4,000. OUP was going to charge me £4,000 to make a thing that I had that had already been. Yeah. So I understand that, but I think these are all complicated issues that we have to be quite careful about, and I'm really keen on independent capacity
I'm glad you made the point because we were right. Rodney, it's your evening.
Two,
one more point.
Yes. Two very short points in reply to you, Bob. One is that I'm not an economist. I don't understand the economics of the music industry, but I understand that the fear about downloaded music driving musicians out of business has not happened.
It's only not
people still want discs as well.
No.
So I don't know what the consequences for buying books will be of open access. But the other one is that I can see all the disadvantages, all the dangers, but I am reminded of what happened when people started translating the Bible out of Latin. Goodness me, ordinary people will read this stuff. Who knows what they will make of it? This is really dangerous. I'm rather attracted by this kind of danger and this set of possibilities when all kinds of people who, through poverty, through distance, through deprivations of all kinds, simply can't get hold of it. And this way, if they've got computers, yes, you're absolutely right.
And internet access.
Short wind-up computers. That's a possibility, and I think it's a risk that is attractive and probably worth it.
Will you do an audible version for people who can't read?
I've done it already. the first element of LSE's involvement in this was an international open access week last year, in which LSE had a spot talking about the implications and values of open access. And I wasn't in LSE at the time. I was in Uzbekistan, actually. But they said, would I do something on my computer? So there it is on the net. A grainy picture of me in front of some beautiful ceramics. I'm not quite sure what they represent. Talking about the video of open access.
Let me just say, first I'd like to thank our panel, all three of our panel, including Rodney, who's written the book. I'm told that, it says mention, that a drinks reception will take place directly. You'd be hard pushed to fail to see that. The plumage of the alcohol will be clear. And of course, there will also be book sales and a signing opportunity outside. So I'd like to thank all of you for your questions and helpful contributions. It's been a jolly and a fun evening as well. So thank you all.